Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, it's the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is, I'm going to say it, probably my favorite person in government of all, State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Welcome back, Tom. It's a great pleasure and an honor to have you here with us.
Alan, it's been too long. I'm glad to be back in studio with you.
Well, you know, we keep trying to get you, but, you know, you're busy, and I don't know what got you back in here this time, but whatever it was, it must have been some incentive. So in any case, you know, I hate to start out this way, but Governor Cuomo and you seem to be at a certain amount of odds here. You have been, as always, a mild-mannered, decent fellow. You don't engage in invective, but he does. And you've been doing your job and auditing the state agencies and coming up with some things that need correcting. That's what your job should be. You went into that controller's office and you took it over. It was a cesspool, and you made it into something that is a highly honorable, extraordinarily favorable ratings in New York State. What is it that goes on with him that he keeps attacking you?
Well, that question is probably better directed elsewhere, but I'll say that, you know, from my perspective, since the audit seemed to be the flashpoint on some of the economic development programs, our goal is to make those programs work as intended, in the interest of taxpayers, making sure we're getting a return on the investment to create jobs and promote economic development. It doesn't matter to me if I'm being attacked. What I, you know, do take exception to is attacking my people, the auditors who do the work. They're professional people. They are hired on merit through civil service. They're not political people. I don't know whether Republicans or Democrats, whether they like me, don't like me, or anybody else in government. When they do their audit work, they have to adhere to very clear auditing and professional standards. If they don't, when they get peer reviewed, they fall short and we lose all credibility. And I think the audits speak for themselves, and they came up with thoughtful, constructive suggestions on how to make these programs work better. I stand behind those audits.
So let's take one of them and just give us an example of what you're talking about.
So take a little bit of a step back. I had said a while ago that now that New York statewide is in a stronger position in terms of job recreation, the recovery is underway. Uneven as it is, many parts of upstate not benefiting from that as much as some of the downstate communities, it was a good time for us to take a look at the various economic development programs, and you alluded to a couple of them. Some are longstanding, some are newer, but, you know, let's take a look. Are they working as intended? Might there be some areas for improvement? So we looked at the advertising by Empire State Development, including the money for the startup program. We looked at the Recharge New York program through the New York Power Authority. We looked at the Excelsior Jobs program through Empire State Development. And what we found, certainly with the startup, the advertising money spent for startup and other...
And what is startup again? You remember? That's
the relatively new initiative. I guess 2014 is when it began to hopefully attract new businesses starting up, often in connection with a SUNY campus in our state. And you get a tax break where you don't have to pay taxes for, or your employees for, I think, like 10 years.
Good deal if you can get it.
Good deal if you can get it. And, you know, some folks say, what about the folks who are struggling with their businesses already? But, I mean, that's a philosophical...
That's right. But then there's also the question of what's this doing to SUNYs? In other words, I taught at SUNYs for 40 years, and, you know, our mission was clear, educate kids. Now, are we turning this into enterprise development?
But that trend's been going on for a while. And not without some merit, I would suggest. But we looked at the advertisement. We said, well, what are we getting? What kind of return are we getting? And what we found is that they were really not using any measurements or metrics to say, for the advertising that we're putting out there, is that how people are hearing about the program? Are people applying for the startup program based on the advertising? If you're a business, right, and you're going to advertise, you do some kind of feedback or survey or analysis of who's coming into your business. Did it have anything to do with the money that you spent? You know, for startup, it was like, you know, $53 million in advertising.
That's a lot of
money. You know, and then they just put out their own report, not ours, that showed at this point, you know, just a few hundred jobs have been created thus far with that program. In the case of the Recharge program with
NYPA. And they come back and they say, well, it's too early. Right.
Well, and in fairness, it is a relatively new program. So people have asked me, should we end the startup program? You know, I would give it a little more time, but it's not unreasonable for us to raise questions about how they can be smarter about spending that money. In the case of Excelsior Jobs and NYPA, you know, we found inadequacy in terms of documentation. We found numbers that seemed to change. In the case of Excelsior, job goals were set and incentives were given based on those goals. And when the business fell short, they still got all the incentive based on the bigger number, but they just lowered the number. You know, the program, based on their own guidelines, we feel is not being administered as tightly as it could be. And then you worry then, are you shortchanging your ultimate goal, which is to create jobs? It's all meant to be constructive and to be helpful to make these programs as intended. And, you know,
so you tell them what they could do to make it better.
Exactly.
What do you tell them?
Well, certainly in terms of their own operations, in the case of the advertising, have some clearly identified upfront metrics that you're going to measure what the return you're getting on that advertising. In the case of both Recharge and Excelsior, do a much more thorough job of documentation. Don't have the business self-certify the numbers as happened in some case. Make sure, in the case of Excelsior, you're not just shifting jobs from one part of the state to another. Make sure that if you're giving them credit for a full-time job, that it is a full-time job, not a part-time job.
And did you find some of that going on?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. No, the audits are very detailed, and you know, they're not meant to be anything other than a constructive recommendation on how government can be more efficient. That's true whether we're auditing a state agency, a public authority, a local government, a school district. That's what our charges and our work is. And again, our auditors are professionals. They're not doing it with a political agenda. It's not an opinion. It is an audit finding. And our goal is to have the recommendations looked at in the spirit that they're offered. We're trying to be helpful.
Now, I feel compelled to ask you this because you said there's nothing political here. There are a number of people who see this fight redounding to your benefit, and that you are preparing to take on Andrew Cuomo in a gubernatorial election of primary. Is that right?
Well, you know, you and I have touched on this topic in the past, haven't we? When usually at the end of your show, when you're trying to, you know, give me what we call agita, as we say in Great Neck.
Yeah.
I love being state controller, and my focus is on running for re-election.
Yeah.
And certainly, again, getting back to the audits, that's not a political agenda. They are not political people. And, you know, those that try to criticize it as a political agenda, you know, really are demeaning the work of our auditors. I stand behind their work. I'm very proud of their professionalism. You know, these audits, when they're completed and we release them, it's not my opinion.
Yeah,
I don't tell the auditors, this is what you got to go to. They produce the report. I look at it, and I've always been able, with great pride, to stand behind their work. Those that would interpret that as a political hit or part of a political agenda, for me, they're missing the point of what audits are all about.
Well, Tom DiNapoli, who assigns the topics, the places that are going to be audited? Could that be a political choice?
Well, you know, it can certainly be a judgment, but, you know, I do that in collaboration with the audit teams, with our deputy controller. We have a deputy controller in charge of the stateside audits, a deputy controller in charge of local governments. It is a process that includes internal suggestions on where to audit. We often get calls or contact from citizens who say, hey, we think something is amiss in this agency or this local government. Could you take a look at it? So where we get the ideas on where to audit and what to audit, it really comes from multiple sources. Yeah, at the end, is there a judgment call as to where to go? And I said very clearly after my reelection, we need to look at the economic development programs. I don't think you can call that a political choice. I think that was more a good judgment choice, that we've been putting tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars into economic development programs in response to the challenges we've had in our state. What kind of return are we getting? And especially for those parts of our state, many of the upstate communities particularly, that haven't benefited from the recovery, is there something we could do a little better? I think that that was a smart, good government choice to do these kinds of audits, and we have a couple of more underway.
So now you're basically the sole trustee for our state funds, retirement funds. How are we doing?
Well, it's been a tough climate. You know, the markets have been very volatile. They've been up and down. We know that. Everybody knows that, whether you're a small investor or a big institutional investor, as we are with the pension fund. We valued the fund, Alan, at the end of the fiscal year, which was March 31st, and we had a positive return, but it was a very, very, very modest one, a 0.19 positive return.
But since that time?
Well, since that time, we've done better. But our long-term goal is 7%. We lowered that assumption from 7.5%. It had been 8 a number of years ago, so we're being more conservative. We are in the minority of pension funds that are at 7. Many are between 7.5 and 8. Some are actually still at 8 and higher. Very few are lower than 7. So I always try to remind people that is a long-term, a multi-year, really a multi-decade goal. So some years you're going to be higher, some years you're going to be lower. So as you point out, we've now gone through the first quarter of our new fiscal year, which ended June 30th, and we had a 2% return for that quarter. Now, that's just a quarterly return. So if we make that 2% every quarter, we'd be at 8% for the end of the year. So that's certainly back in the range as to what we think are our long-term goal that can be achieved. But it's way too early in the year to say how this year is going. We know the markets have been hitting record highs of late. Here's the challenge we have, Alan, and I'll try to say it quickly. As a pension fund, our safest place to put money is in fixed income, treasuries, bonds. Money is so cheap now. The interest rates are so low. You don't make any money by putting your money in safe harbor.
Yeah, right.
And by law, we only can put a small part of our money in alternatives like real estate and private equity. So we end up with the biggest chunk of our money in public equities in the stock market. So when the stock market's going great, everybody says, why don't you put all your money in the stock market? And when the stock market's not doing good, you know, we get hit by it. So we've been trying to be as diversified as we can within the limitations that we have by law. I have confidence in our chief investment officer, Vicki Fuller, and the strategy she has mapped out. But it has been an environment of lower return than we've had. And I think all the pension funds are struggling. I'll just mention, Alan, that we will, in the not-too-distant future, put out the rates we're going to charge our government employers. We're finalizing those numbers. We've cut that rate 3 years in a row, relieved some of the pressure on local budgets. I'm hoping this year we can at least keep those rates stable. I'm hoping we won't have to raise them because we had a tough year this year. But we have confidence long-term. That promise to our public workers, those who are retired today and those who look forward to being retired, that defined benefit pension will be there for them. New York is not Illinois or New Jersey. We are well-funded. We have confidence that we're going to be able to pay these benefits and do it in a way that recognizes the cost burden on our taxpayers.
Now, we do know that you have a lot of power, or the Comptroller's Office has a lot of power, to raise expectations about what companies that you invest in, because you own a lot of stock, how they're going to behave. And for example, one of those is political spending by corporations. Where are you on that one?
You know, since Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision came out, there's been, appropriately so, a real concern about corporate spending in the political arena, certainly heightened by the year that we're going through right now. And it's not just spending on campaigns, it's spending on candidates, it's spending on other kinds of campaigns, trade associations, other kinds of advocacy work. You know, we're not talking about money that a CEO may put in out of their own pocket for a candidate. We're talking about money that comes out of the corporate bottom line. And even when the Supreme Court made that very unfortunate decision, I hope it gets overturned, Justice Kennedy said, you know, this should be allowed, but of course, public disclosure where this money is going, that will be the way to ensure that the money's being spent in an appropriate way. Well, that's not what's happened. Money's being spent, and it's often not being disclosed. So we took the position as an investor with public companies that, putting aside the philosophical argument whether there should be any corporate money being spent on politics and lobbying, at a minimum, there should be disclosure, as was intended in that decision. So we've been pressing the companies we invest in, if you do not have a disclosure policy on political spending, we would like you to have that. And we engage with companies. We file shareholder resolutions where necessary. We've had some success. Actually, this year, we have 6 additional companies that have signed on to a model political spending disclosure policy. We're up now with our engagements. Other pension funds are doing similar work, up to about 34 companies now in response to our request to have moved in this direction. Why? We want to be sure that the spending that's happening is tied to the bottom line of the long-term profitability of the company and protecting our investment.
So can you punish them if they don't go?
Well, on? You know, how could you? Well, you could punish them.
Sell their stock?
Yeah, but, you know, we lose our leverage then. You know, people often say, you know, divest, and this comes up with other topics as well. But, you know, I feel we lose our leverage. What I found is that with some companies, if you don't win on the first round, if you keep at it, you start to build more support. And eventually, either you do really well to shareholder vote, or the company says, you know what, I don't need to be bothered by New York anymore. Let's agree with this. Or in the case of Qualcomm, you remember.
What's that?
Qualcomm was a company we invested in, and we actually brought a suit in the Delaware Court of Chancery for what was called a books and records action. We said, as a shareholder, we want to look at the books. We want to see where your money's going. In response to our taking that step, they then agreed to do disclosure. In fact, now they're one of the best companies in terms of political disclosure. So I'm not sure you'd call that punishment, but there is leverage that we have. Ultimately, Alan, what I think we need to have is a more standardized strategy. For us to go company by company, and we're invested in thousands of companies, even if other institutional investors engage in this work, it's going to take forever to get to every company. I'd like to see the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, come up with a standard for disclosure across all companies. It really would be the smart step to take. Mary Jo White is there, a great, you know, a New Yorker. you know, a lot of the issues at that level become very contentious. And, you know, this is one that they haven't tackled. But we keep writing, along with Scott Stringer and other New York City controller and other counterparts, urging the SEC to be the entity to come up with a standardized approach to political disclosure. Until that happens, Alan, or until the Supreme Court reverses its decision, maybe we'll have some new justices in the not-too-distant future, we're going to keep pressing for disclosure of political spending by corporations.
Let's move on. But Tom, I'm sorry to do this to you. I know that you give very full answers to the very brief questions that I did. But you got to go really fast now, because otherwise we won't make it. Has Brexit, you know, the English getting out of the European market, has that in fact had an effect on our financial situation?
I think it's fair to say at the time the vote happened, the market certainly went down, and that was right before the June 30th end of the quarter. You did see a recovery shortly thereafter, and certainly now that we're, you know, into the summer months, you've seen a significant recovery. I think the short answer to that question is we really don't know long term what the impact will be, but it is one of those uncertainties out there that we all have to continue to monitor. We are part of a global economy, so it's possible it could have an impact, positive or negative, down the road.
My TIA-CREF keeps going up. My thing. So I'm wondering whether that's just something I'm being set up to fail. In other words,
I think we don't.
I don't want to be superstitious.
No, but I think the challenge is the markets clearly are in a state of volatility, and I think that's going to continue for the foreseeable future.
There's an ethics bill. It stinks. It's a rotten thing. They came up with the usual lukewarm nonsense in the legislature when we should have done things like, and you came out of legislature, so you know about this stuff. All I want to do is I want them to have a limit like the U.S. Congress does on how much they can make on the outside.
Yeah.
They won't do that. And I don't like it, and I wondered where you are.
No, I agree. I think the congressional model is one that makes sense. When I was in the legislature, basically a full-time position. I did some adjunct professor work, but that's about it. Certainly, you know, as you know, you come from the academic world, you don't make a lot of money doing that. So having a severe limit on outside income will avoid some of the conflicts and problems that we've had in the past. But you know what? You really have to get to the other reforms. Campaign finance reform, too much money in politics now. You have to have public financing so you could encourage competition. You need to have fair redistricting. Until you do those changes as well, you're not going to have the kind of more open government process that we all deserve in New York.
Well, Tom, something I've never understood is that Andrew Cuomo, when he was running for governor the first time, he said he was not going to sign any reapportionment bill, which you just mentioned, allowing these characters to draw their own districts. So now they're drawing their own districts and keeping the Republicans in office in the Senate, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're a politician. What do you think of the fact that it would appear that Andrew Cuomo seems to want to keep the Senate in Republican hands?
Well, I think of late he's been saying some different things.
He says one thing, does another.
And, you saw the poll the other day that the voters seem to feel that Trump heading the ticket is going to hurt the Republicans. You know, look, we'll see.
What will that mean in New York?
I think it could very well mean that we'll have a Democratic Senate. The problem, Alan, as you know, is what happens to the IDC, the Independent Democratic Conference.
Otherwise known by some people like me as the traitors.
Yeah, well, but
the people who went over.
But
and,
if they still
and,
hold
yeah.
the balance,
yeah.
you know, where will
are
they go?
Are you kidding? Tom DiNapoli, you know very well that if Andrew Cuomo calls those people in, Jeff Klein and his cronies, and calls them into the office and says, you get back where you belong with the Democrats, that they'll do it. They have to do it.
Look, I'm a Democrat, proudly so. I believe that the Democrats should caucus together. You may have your internal battles and disagreements over who should be the leader, but once you have a voter, a consensus, or you have a decision in your own conference, your conference has to stick together. That's the purpose of having political parties. So hope is that happens. However that happens, I hope it happens, and I hope it happens soon.
Well, economically, if Hillary wins New York and the Senate becomes Democratic, you're a guy who's looking at the economics of New York. Are we going to do better?
Well, you know, look, I'd like to think that doing better will be less connected to, you know, which party is in control. But I happen to, as a Democrat and someone who's has a tremendous regard for the leader of the Democrats, Andrew Stewart Cousins, I think that the Democrats will be very capable of providing leadership in the Senate. I think they learned from some of their mistakes of a couple of years ago where they didn't exactly have a great run, as you could recall. And I think if the Democrats do win the Senate, it's going to be because they're able to win outside of New York City. And if the Democratic Conference, as the Assembly Democrats have done since they took over in 74...
You came from there yourself.
Yeah, yeah. But you remember when they first won in 74, the Watergate year, that's what changed the political dynamic. You know, it was all Republican.
So could this be the Trump year?
It could be. But the success of the Democratic majority has been the ability to have a multi-region strategy in terms of governing the state. And that's why the majority is now, whatever it is, it's well over 100 seats now at 150. If the Senate Democrats embrace that similar strategy where not only their base in New York City, but suburban communities, upstate communities, rural communities are as much a part of their agenda, they will have a majority that can grow and they will do right by the state economically. I think the model of how the Assembly Democratic Conference has functioned, a very diverse conference, but an inclusive strategy, that's what I think the Senate Democrats have to embrace.
Okay, Tom DiNapoli, I want to talk national politics with you for a moment here. The New York Times is reporting that Trump has a 13% chance of winning and Hillary has a 87% chance of winning. But they always say in their upshot column that Trump could well win. Mm. Do you think so?
I think less so today, perhaps, than I did. I had the great experience to be in Philadelphia. It was a wonderful convention, the best one I ever went to. I think the party left there more united than when they arrived, and usually Democrats are not known for unity.
Fratricide.
Bernie Sanders did a great job. I thought his speech was one of the most effective, and certainly when I talk to folks who have been supporting Sanders, most of them now are on board with Hillary, whereas when I talk to many of my Republican friends, and you know, I come from a bellwether area down on Long Island, many of them don't want to vote for Trump. They may not want to vote for Hillary, but they don't want to vote for Trump. So I think that the way this is headed, Hillary is in a very, very strong position. But just as we said, the markets are volatile. I think politics is volatile. What happens internationally? What may happen in this country? You know, it's not over till it's over. We all have the, you know, those races where we knew the sure bets, and the next day it changed. Hmm. And obviously, look, Donald Trump has gone much further than anybody would have predicted.
Do you know him? Have you ever met him?
I met him. Yeah.
What's he like? What's he really like?
You know, I think what you see is how he is. I mean, I wasn't on The Apprentice show or anything, so I never got to see the, you know, the rough side. But look, he's obviously very clever, and he's a great marketer. And if you would have told me he was going to be the Republican nominee, I wouldn't have predicted that.
You could have joined the club.
I could have joined the club. But so people who discount him right now, I think you do that at your own peril. And overconfidence is often what happens to candidates who end up losing. Hillary certainly is not behaving as someone who's overconfident. She's working real hard. I didn't know much about Tim Kaine until I saw him in action at the convention. I'm very impressed with him. I think it's a great ticket. And the ability, perhaps, to have the kind of landslide that we haven't seen for a bit for the Democrats, I think that will be great. I'd love to see Chuck Schumer as our Senate Majority Leader down in Washington. How great for New York to have the Senate Majority Leader and the President living in New York State. That would be great. Maybe we'll pick up some congressional seats, and I think it could be a good year. But hey, it's still summer. It's not done yet.
No. As for me, I'm a little ticked off these days about the fact that both Hillary and Chuck have said it's too early to say that Preet Bharara would be reappointed. That makes me furious because he's a great hero of mine, and I think it's a big mistake. And now we hear that the Clinton Foundation is being looked at by the Bharara people, so maybe that has something to do with her hesitancy to talk about reappointment.
Well, I think Preet Bharara is not only your hero, I think he's a hero to so many people in the state of New York. I think he's done a great job. Our office has had a very professional and productive relationship working together with him on some of these public integrity issues. And, you know, I just think he's done an outstanding job as U.S. attorney. I don't know what his personal interests are, but if he continues that position,
I think Springsteen, I know that.
Well, I think I did read that somewhere. I think he's done a great job. And if he continues there, it certainly would be a good thing.
It's always great to talk to New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Preet Bharara is a hero. So are you, Tom. As far as I'm concerned, you have done the impossible. You've brought us back to a department that really does its work in an apolitical way. And I thank you so much for doing that and for being here with us. It's always great to see you.
Thanks, Alan.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Mm-hmm.